Hello, and welcome to the Interpreter Foundation Scripture Roundtable. This is the 58th roundtable, and the discussion for today is going to be Lesson 8 from the Old Testament manual. And the title or the theme of today's discussion is Living Righteously in a Wicked World. And I am Stephen Smoot, your moderator, and with me is Craig Foster and Jeffrey Bradshaw. And so we're going to say a few things about Abraham and Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah. These are some of the more provocative and exciting stories from the Old Testament. There's a lot of good, juicy stuff in there, right? And there's a lot of good stuff to talk about, and also some great principles that we can extract from these accounts and apply them in our lives. So we're going to be discussing that a little bit. Let's start out by discussing a little bit Abraham and his family. The first bullet point in the manual is discussing Abraham and his family settling in Hebron, whereas Lot and his family settle near Sodom. And, you know, there's significance in this. And so we want to talk a little bit about that. We want to talk about the idea of, you know, pitching your tent in different specific directions or focusing your intentions in different directions. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. Let's start with Jeff Bradshaw. And if you want to sort of get us set up or get us started with some comments you have about this part of the lesson.
Sure. You know, it's true that we talk about Abraham pitching his tent not towards Sodom, Lot doing the same, and I do like the quote in the lesson from Elder Ballard that talks about being in the world but not of the world. In Abraham, we don't find, you know, the person that was drawn toward the world as Lot was, apparently, but we find someone who is willing to live in the world, and one of the signs of that is he always had an open tent door to people who were in need, and he was known for his hospitality. We encountered that in chapter 17, where he welcomed the three visitors. In fact, some accounts say that he actually went out and sought after them in a day that was so hot, God bored a hole in hell to try to keep Abraham inside, but he couldn't do it. There's a couple quotes I'd like to have. These are not from Scripture, but I think they characterize the flavor a personality that was available both in the scriptures and in some of the oral traditions that floated around about Abraham in the Jewish world. Hugh Nibley wrote this, and I like the way he says it. In the most inhospitable of worlds, Abraham was the most hospitable of men. It was said that charity was asleep in the world, and Abraham awakened it. I love the way Nibley writes. Even before he went to Canaan, he held continual open house near Haran to try to counteract the evil practices of the time. When he was forced to move, he dug wells and planted trees along the way, living blessings for those he would never see. Arriving and settling in Beersheba, he built a garden and grove and put gates on each of the four sides as a welcome to strangers from every direction. So that if a traveler came to Abraham and entered any gate which was in his road, and remained there, he ate and drank, for the house of Abraham was always open to the sons of men that passed and repassed and came continually to his house. Now, I like two of the stories. I also want to share specific stories about this. Has to do with his requirement that the honor and praise of this guest be directed toward God and not toward him. The legend goes, our father Abraham would bring Abraham into his home, give them food and drink, befriend them, and thus attract them, and then convert them and bring them under the wings of the presence, meaning under the wings of the Lord. After travelers whom he made his guests had eaten and drunk, they stood up to bless him. He said to them, was it of mine that you ate? You ate that which belongs to the everlasting God of the world. Thank, praise, and bless him who spoke, and the world came into being. But if the traveler refused to thank God, Abraham would say, pay what you owe me. When the wayfarer asked, how much do I owe you? Abraham would reply, a jug of wine, so much, a pound of wheat, so much, a loaf of bread, so much. Who do you suppose is giving you wine in the wilderness, meat in the wilderness, bread in the wilderness? Wayfarer would now get the idea and that he either had to pray or bless God. So he would stand up and say then, blessed be the everlasting God of the world, whose bounty we have partaken. So I love that little story. One other story that reminds me of some of the guests that we get that we don't necessarily enjoy having in our homes is the story of an idol worshiper who refused to honor the Lord for the bread he'd received. Abraham grew enraged at the man and rose and drove him away into the desert. But then when God saw that even Abraham was irked by this idol worshiper who'd refused to bless God, God rebuked him, saying, "Consider the 198 years, all the time that man has lived. I have borne with him and did not destroy him from the face of the earth. Instead, I gave him bread to eat and clothed him, and I did not have him lack for anything. How did you come to drive him out without permitting him to lodge in your tent, even for a single night?" At that, Abraham swiftly brought the man back to his tent and sent him away in peace the next morning. I love those stories, and I think they partake somewhat of the spirit of hospitality that we ought to have. It's not a spirit of, I guess, being in the world, as Lot was drawn to the world, but it's a state of being open to the world, of being tolerant and loving to all men, and not only just admitting people who come to our door and beg us for help, but actually making the world a better place, as Abraham did, so people are hospitable and happy. Wow, what an example for us all in the spirit of those stories.
Absolutely. I love the fact that you touched on the importance of Abraham's hospitality, and that's going to contrast very vividly with the inhospitality of the inhabitants of Sodom, but we're going to discuss that at a later point. Craig, do you want to talk a little bit about the significance of pitching your tent, towards a certain area or towards a certain concentration or something like that?
Right. It talks about how while Abraham had dwelt in Hebron, Lot had pitched his tent toward Sodom and Sodom and Gomorrah. And so, we talk about that obviously Lot's interests lay in that direction. And while it appears in the scriptures that Lot was a good man, he seemed to be kind of just walking on the edge there in terms of at least focusing his attention toward a city or cities that were evil. And we're going to talk about what did that evil involve. But what I wanted to do was to talk about how comparing that to today. And we're told to basically be careful where we pitch our tents or in what direction we pitch our tent, so to speak. And I have some quotes that deal with this, modern parallels with Sodom and Gomorrah, that I thought I would read. One is from Gordon B. Hinckley, that he said, "The traditional family is under heavy attack. I do not know that things were worse in the times of Sodom and Gomorrah. We see similar conditions today. They prevail all across the world. I think our father must weep as he looks down upon his wayward sons and daughters." And then he also stated in an article in the November 2001 Ensign, "We live in a season when fierce men do terrible and despicable things. We live in a season of war. We live in a season of arrogance. We live in a season of wickedness, pornography, immorality. All of the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah haunt our society. Our young people have never faced a greater challenge. We have never seen more clearly the lecherous face of evil." Boyd K. Packer wrote, "Nothing happened in Sodom and Gomorrah which exceeds in wickedness and depravity that which surrounds us now. Words of profanity, vulgarity, and blasphemy are heard everywhere. Unspeakable wickedness and perversion were once hidden in dark places. Now they are in the open, even accorded legal protection. At Sodom and Gomorrah, these things were localized. Now they are spread across the world, and they are among us." And Richard G. Scott basically voiced the same opinion that there's an abandonment of virtue, righteousness, personal integrity, traditional marriage and family life. Sodom and Gomorrah was the epitome of unholy life in the Old Testament. It was isolated then. Now that condition is spread over the world. And then finally, just one other quote that I thought was interesting, and it was from Neil A. Maxwell, in which he said, "It is likewise a grave error to underestimate secularism's dulling, desensitizing influence on traditional values." And I wanted to just comment, you know, I've read basically doom and gloom here, but we as Latter-day Saints, we have a very, I guess you could say it's kind of a fine line that we walk. We need to be in the world. We can't, you know, hide in the mountains or something like that. We need to be in the world, but we need to make sure that we are not of the world. And it is so easy with the various events of surrounding us, of everyday life, for us to more and more tend to be of the world rather than in the world. And quite often, we don't even recognize that we're being pulled that way. And so basically, and we're going to talk about, a little later about what were the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah. They weren't just sexual sins. They weren't just immorality. There were a number of different sins, and I really appreciated, you know, about what President Hinckley had stated about arrogance, about desire to go to war, et cetera, and so forth. And so it goes beyond just sexual immorality. But I guess the message that came clear to me as I prepared for this discussion tonight was that we need to be careful how we walk that line to make sure we don't step over, that we're not drawn into being of the world while we are in the world, if that makes sense.
Yes, that very much makes sense. And one thing I've always appreciated about President Hinckley and others, some of the other general authorities who have, you know, said these warnings, they've given these warnings about the wickedness in the world around us, they always tell us, they instruct us as saints to go into the world and try to make it a better place.
Exactly.
It's not, you know, they're not saying to, like you said, Craig, to go hide in the mountains, become isolationists. They encourage us to actively participate in our communities to make them better and to try to counteract some of these unfortunate problems and sins that we see around us. And so even though it is, you know, very, very grave and very serious, some of the sins that are being committed these days around the world, we can take steps to try to correct that and be a force for good in the world. So,
yes. One other comment, which actually you made me think of it as you were talking. You know, even though they gave these rather dire messages, President Hinckley, I think anyone who knew him would say he was certainly not not a pessimist. President Hinckley had a very good outlook toward life and toward the world, and both he and now President Monson have emphasized the fact that Latter-day Saints, in a world that is lacking in love, that Latter-day Saints need to have an outpouring of love toward not only fellow members but to those who don't belong to our church. So we're not going to, once again, we're not going to go and hide in the mountains. We need to be in the world, and we need to be examples of the love that comes through the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Absolutely. Thank you for those comments, Craig. Let's move on now to the second part of the lesson manual, which is discussing Melchizedek and his interaction with Abraham. We know that Abraham goes and pays tithes to Melchizedek, and the biblical story, however, doesn't say much more about it, you know, beyond that, right? We have this short interaction, and that's about it. We don't know much about Melchizedek, where he comes from, what he does, what his significance is. He's just sort of there. But thankfully, the Joseph Smith translation includes many verses that expounds or clarifies who Melchizedek was and what his role was and why Abraham went to him. And so if you look in the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis chapter 14, it's between verses 25 and 40. We won't go through all of them since there's a lot you could, you know, discuss and read there. But some of the highlights that the Joseph Smith translation gives us about Melchizedek, for one thing, we know that he was a man of God, a man of great faith, ever since he was a child. We know that he was such a great high priest after the order of the Son of God, is what the text calls it, that we now call it the Melchizedek priesthood, right? That's from the Doctrine and Covenants. He's sort of the example of how to be a great priest, priesthood holder, after this order. And so, you know, it makes sense that Abraham would go to him as, you know, the greatest priesthood leader that he had at the time. We know also from the Joseph Smith translation that what Melchizedek was trying to undertake with his people and his city, it says, for example, in around verse 33 and 34, that he was the prince of a city, Salem, and that also he was trying to go after the same order that Enoch and his people had walked in, which, of course, you know, brought them translated up to God. And so, you know, we see another tie-in here with Melchizedek and the other patriarchs and the earlier prophets from Genesis. And there's some very significant temple and covenant themes going on here. You know, it's wonderful that we have the Joseph Smith translation to clarify some of these aspects about Melchizedek. I don't know if, Jeff, if you have any thoughts on Melchizedek, or Craig, if you do, anything you'd like to share about that or any insights you might have.
Yeah, maybe I'll build on some of the things you said. I think in realizing the greatness of Melchizedek, as you've said, Stephen, we realize that he was a type of Christ, and that really applies in many dimensions. His very name means something. In fact, we know his name is both a personal name and a title. Melchi means my king. Tzedek is a righteousness, so really my king is righteousness. He's a righteous king. He was a type of Christ in that, in the sense of the priesthood, as you referred to. Maybe I'll just read a little bit from D&C 107. There are in the church two priesthoods, Melchizedek and Aaronic, including the Levitical priesthood. Why the first is called the Melchizedek priesthood is because Melchizedek was such a great high priest, as you said, Stephen. Before his day, it was called the Holy Priesthood after the order of the Son of God. But out of respect or reverence to the name of the Supreme Being, to avoid the too frequent repetition of the name, they, the church in ancient days, called the priesthood after Melchizedek, or the Melchizedek priesthood. All other authorities or offices in the church are appendages to this priesthood. Now, Abraham, as you remember back in verse 1, we won't prolong this too long, but what did he seek? What did he want more than anything else? He wanted the blessings of the fathers, and ultimately the blessings of the priesthood. So he had gone through a series of tests. He'd been tested in many ways, with children, with his hospitality, with trials with his family life. And in most recently, before Melchizedek came, in his encounter with the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, and his integrity in not accepting from them even a shoelatch, if I remember, or a thread. I can't remember which it says in the account. And so it was at that moment, after he'd basically proven himself in every count that needed to be proved for him to receive it, that he received the Melchizedek priesthood under the hands of Melchizedek himself, and entered the order of the Son of God. Now, that order doesn't just signify the order of Melchizedek priesthood generally, but we know that it signifies the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood. And just as a Melchizedek was a king and a priest in the priesthood sense, as well as in the secular sense of being a king of Salem, he was in a position to ordain Abraham to that same priesthood. And so at that encounter, as we understand more fully as Latter-day Saints, Abraham received from him the blessing he'd longed for since he was very much younger, namely the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood under the hands of this great prophet leader.
Absolutely, and I think it's significant that Well, we won't go too much into this because of time, and I'm sure it'll come up in another discussion. But this understanding, or this theme of receiving the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood, Joseph Smith in the Nauvoo era of the church would teach that that involves ordinances in the temple. Mm-hmm. And so we can very much, I believe, associate Abraham's experience with Melchizedek in receiving the fullness of that priesthood as being a temple context, or, you know, having temple covenants related to that in some sense. So thank you for those insights, Jeff. I think that's a good little overview of Melchizedek and his relationship with Abraham. We can conclude now with the third part of the lesson, which is about the Lord destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. And today, when most Christians and Jews, or even people who don't have a particular faith, when they think of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and when they think of, you know, what led them to be destroyed, the first thing that usually comes to mind is sexual immorality. We won't go into the account here tonight, but you know, the men of Sodom did some unspeakable things that you know, got them in a lot of trouble, and so, you know, the natural association is with sexual impropriety or immorality. However, and Craig sort of touched on this earlier, that's only part of the story. We tend to miss the fuller picture when we focus in or hone in on just that one aspect of the account. So I had an Old Testament professor, David Seeley, who would often remind our class that the book of Ezekiel, chapter 16, actually discusses Sodom and describes what the sin of Sodom is. And the book of Ezekiel in chapter 49 of verse 16 says, first of all, that pride was the sin of Sodom, the iniquity, it says, of Sodom. Fullness of bread and abundance of idleness was in her and her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. In other words, I think that the account of Lot in Sodom is a good antitype to Abraham's hospitality. I think one of the most egregious sins of the men of Sodom was their flagrant breach of the hospitality culture and expectations of their day in how they handled Lot and his family, and of course the angels that had come to warn Lot. And so maybe we can conclude with some thoughts on how we can avoid the sin of Sodom. And again, we're not necessarily talking about the sexual sins or breaking law of chastity, but perhaps, you know, how we can be like Abraham, in other words, and not like the men of Sodom, and how we interact with others. So I'll turn it over to you, Jeff and Craig, if you have any thoughts on Sodom and the sin of Sodom, any insights that you may have.
Go ahead, Craig.
Well, just kind of reiterating what had been said before in terms of the fact that while obviously as Latter-day Saints we know to avoid the big sins, you know, sexual immorality, other things like that, dishonesty, etc., but as you pointed out, Steve, it had much more to do with not only with those sins, which obviously were there in Sodom and Gomorrah, but there were sins dealing with pride, with a lack of love and concern for those who were in need, for the way that they treated other people, such as the angels that came to warn Lot. And so I think a message that we as Latter-day Saints should take from that is we obviously we're going to avoid the big sins for the most part, but it's the little sins, it's the pride, it's the lack of love and charity and other things like that that I mean, I don't know about you, but those are usually the things that, you know, when I have to reevaluate every so often, I go, okay, am I really being charitable? Am I really showing love? And am I doing the little things that add up to the big things. And so I think that the message for Latter-day Saints is not only the big, huge black and white, but it's the more subtle shades of gray that we need to make sure that we avoid and that we make rather than our weaknesses, our strengths.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that clarification and distinction. Jeff, do you have any concluding thoughts before we end tonight?
Sure. I'd like to just go back a little bit again to that theme of hospitality and charity, first of all. One of the most touching, tender stories for me is that pleading that Abraham makes on behalf of Sodom and Gomorrah. Again, it's very much a line of discernment. There are times when I guess justice must be served, and the Lord did serve it up in spades to Sodom and Gomorrah, yet there's something beautiful about Abraham's care for those people and the fact that he was willing to plead with the Lord for them, even though he knew very well that they were in very sorry state. You remember he pled with the Lord and said, if there are 50, will thou also destroy and not spare the place for 50 righteous that are therein? And the Lord said he wouldn't do it. And then he said, what if there's flat 5? Will you destroy it if we're lacking 5? And the Lord said he wouldn't destroy it for 45, and then 40, and then 30, and then 20, and 10. And Abraham was just very, gentle in his negotiations. He says, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I'll speak to thee, but what once peradventure there be 10? And he gets down to 10, and he stops there. Again, the Lord, it also is a sign of the Lord's mercy that for those who plead and pray and perhaps preserve a city, the Lord will be merciful to those in that city. An interesting insight, or at least perspective from Jewish thought, is why did he stop at the number of 10? Well, we can talk about the number of individuals in Lot's family, and that might be one clue. But the Jewish view of that was that 10 was the smallest number of men that could form a minyan, a prayer circle. Mm-hmm. So it was the fact of being able to form a circle to pray in that line of Jewish thinking that saved the city. Let me just read this quote from President Spencer W. Kimball that's in our manual. Our world now is so much the same as it was in the day of the Nephite prophet who said, if it were not for the prayers of the righteous, you would even now be visited with utter destruction. Alma 10:22. Of course, there are yet many upright and faithful who live all the commandments and whose lives and prayers keep the world from destruction. And I realize those are more than the Latter-day Saints who pray and work for good in the world. And I'm grateful to live a little bit in the South. I live in Northwest Florida. We've got some wonderful, wonderful people in this part of the world, and I'm grateful that their prayers join mine for the safety and well-being and goodness of our community. Maybe I just want to say one other thing, too, with regard, again, to this pride of this sin of pride or hubris, overweening pride, I guess, as that's defined, that was part of the problem of Sodom and Gomorrah. I just finished an article not too long ago by a scholar named Brian Doyle, who talks about both the name of Lot and a little bit his character in a way that is very revealing. It turns out Lot, of course, is a very ambivalent figure. As Craig said, he's a pretty good guy, but he also has his issues. The name Lot, as a lot of the names of the biblical characters, is itself revealing. It can mean to be wrapped closely, tightly, enveloped, or to be like covered or veiled or concealed. And so many of the Jewish commentators say he was blind to a degree. He was veiled. He couldn't see the nose in front of his face. He missed important things. Brian Doyle's article talks about the contrast between Abraham and Lot in terms of the leading words that have to do with doors and entrances. He speaks about Abraham, who when the three messengers come in chapter 17, he's standing at the tent door, that Abraham, his wife Sarai, is standing at her door when she listens to the messengers, and he's always at the ready in various places, and that same word is repeated many times about his door. That is anyway, without going too much more depth. Lot, on the other hand, when visitors come into Sodom, he does not recognize them. He's veiled. He doesn't recognize them as true messengers of God. His understanding is veiled. And even when they're into his house, it talks about not only his door, but the outer entrance. The men of Sodom are trying to gain access to the outer entrance. Lot, wanting to protect his visitors, but not recognizing their divine, goes out there and tries to stop the men, blocks the outer entrance or gate to his property. They try to break in and so forth. And finally, the messengers, the angels, have to pull him into the house and protect him behind the door. And it's at that point that finally the veil is taken off his mind and he's able to recognize them for the true messengers, which they are. And so there's a theme that runs through there. I guess I didn't do a very good job of summarizing Brian Doyle's paper, but of living and so that we can recognize the Lord's hand in all things, so we can recognize his messengers, so we can discern between good and right and wrong, as Abraham was not only always on the ready to welcome and do good, but spiritually ready to be able to discern when the Lord wanted him to act and discern when the Lord's messengers were there. So that's just a lesson I take from the story of Abraham and from this recent paper that Brian Doyle so recently put on our lap. So I hope we can all become a little bit more like Abraham in that way.
Absolutely. Wonderful insights. Thank you, Jeff. And we'll see what we can do to maybe get that article to accompany this roundtable for anybody who wants to look at it. Well, that's about all the time that we have for our discussion tonight. The other last thing that I can recommend for any of our listeners is, and we'll put the link with this video as well, there's a sermon or devotional by Elder Jeffrey R. Holland titled Remember Lot's Wife, I believe it's titled. And that also touches on some of the themes that we've discussed tonight, so we may include that for your pleasure to read if you would like. But we would like to thank you for joining us tonight at the Scripture Roundtable. This has been number 58, and we have been discussing living righteously in a wicked world from the Sunday School Old Testament Gospel Doctrine Manual. I am your moderator and host, Stephen Smoot, and with me has been Jeffrey Bradshaw and Craig Foster. And we thank you for joining us and hope you will join us next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.